Is that a word? It looks like a scribble to me.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comment, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wu. The only other voice you're going to hear on today's program is Garrison Keillor, the writer's almanac. The two of us are going to spend the time talking about reading and writing on Scribble. Reading and writing. We spend a lot of time doing that, don't we, Roald?
Well, and a lot of time talking about how important it is. I suspect that if you asked 10 people who are all avid readers why they read, you would probably get 10 different answers. They would range all the way from W.H. Auden's Poetry Makes Nothing Happen to Shelley's Poets Are the Unacknowledged Legislators of the World. So I thought it would be fun today, this is selfishly my idea, to tell you a little bit about one of the great introductions to a novel that I've ever come across, and that was when I was teaching Henry James, and I think it's the introduction to his novel called The American. But there is a metaphor there for reading that I'd like to try out on you and see what you think. So this might take a little gab on my part.
Well, it says, I like you trying things out on me.
Well, okay, I'll try this out.
Never know what to expect.
It's basically a metaphor. James suggests, imagine that there is a huge building with row upon row upon row of windows facing a courtyard. The courtyard, says James, is the courtyard of life. And behind each window is every single human alive, alone in his own cell, put there by his own personality, by the age in which he's living, by his ability to see clearly or not. That is, we're each in a prison of ourselves. And what James is trying to do is explain why it is that just because Chaucer came along doesn't mean that earlier literature went out of date, or just because Shakespeare wrote doesn't mean that Greek drama is out of date. How can it be that two people, says James, with views like Joseph Conrad, who has an affirmative view of life, and his contemporary Thomas Hardy, whose view of life is gloomy and dim, is one right and the other wrong? Are they both wrong? Are they just making it up? And here's what James says. He says, behind each of these windows, there you and I are, trapped. But, he said, we want to look out other people's windows too and see a broader view of this courtyard called life. And he says, a person from the next window could probably send up a report. I see the following things out my window. He might even read a description of those things. But that's not like looking out those windows. Only when the writer turns to creative writing, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, can the writer take you behind his window and suddenly learn for a moment what it must be like to have been Shakespeare, to have been Conrad, to have been Dostoevsky. In that way, each of us, by reading great works of literature, depending upon whether the person telling you is telling the truth or not. We tend not to tell the truth sometimes. We make it up. We invent it. But if that person is telling the truth, then for a moment the scales drop from our eyes and we end up at the end of the book a little less prejudiced than we were before. And the more we read and the more we experience what life is like, the better our prejudices are going to be.
I think the problem, or one of the problems in life, is that we
bring to reading our own prejudices. And sometimes we would read a book and we fight against what we read if it opposes us.
Don't you think that's the mark of a good book, right? If I read something and it's something I already agree with, I haven't learned anything. I used to take a look at works of art at art fairs back when we were still buying, when we had walls that still were a little bare. And I often discovered that when I would buy something, because, boy, I love that, I would get it home and within a year, yeah, that's not so good. But if it was one of those things I made fun of, my kid could have done that. Isn't that upside down? All of a sudden, the more I live with it, the more I grow into it. And I think that's true with books, too. Not every book that I like today is a book that I started out liking. It threatened me, or it caused me to stretch in unpleasant ways. So maybe we ought to read unpleasant books.
Well, it's true. It's always good to get a contrary opinion. You hate people who make up contrary facts, but or posit worlds that are built on theories that, are not too. I think of Ayn Rand. Her followers are just absolutely besotted with this, and Ayn Rand herself didn't live by her own principles.
No,
sometimes we get locked into these theologies or modes of thought and so on, and we are really in a prison. And I think when you read, it takes a certain, freedom of mind that you read and you're willing to take in what's there. You can react to it in a number of ways, but at least take it in and see. What I like are books that explain things for me or that offer me new ways of thinking. I'm tedious about Teilhard de Chardin because he gave me a vision of science and the world and so on that I thought, I don't know if this is true or not, but I hope it is.
Right.
Because it suddenly caused me to think about creation in a different way. And Julian Jaynes, boy, he answered so many questions for me in history when his book about the origin of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind. He may be right, he may be wrong, but boy, did he clear up a lot of stuff for me.
Well, James would say it's not necessarily right or wrong. It's just, Conrad, in his affirmative view, is just looking out a different window from the gloomy writers. And they can all be true. What bothers me, and the reverse of this is true too, what happens to most students when they get to college is they look out their window and they don't see what they think the teacher wants them to see. And so instead they pretend and they say, oh, that can't be true. Nobody wants to hear about that. And it is hard to get students to look out their particular window. They can see something that even the teacher can't see because they're them. Let me just give you an example. I use as an example of horrible writing the first sentence I wrote in theme number 5 at St. Olaf College in 1951, thinking I was really going to knock the socks off the teacher by showing my erudition. And so I wrote, this is the first line of that theme, I almost hate to say it, far in the west at day's end, old soul sinks his flaming head upon the pillow of the horizon. And I can still remember late at night, the night before the theme was due, that this is just going to knock him. This is A+, right? Then I can also recall a freshman, a young woman, rather shy, who wrote...
I want to know what your teacher thought of that line.
A C.
C.
And I, in fact, before I got that C, I was going into aeronautical engineering. And I can recall saying in that line, okay, I'm going to show this guy that I really can write. And of course, as usual, I overdid it and ended up being an English teacher. But let me give you a contrasting theme. Here's a young girl. She's been at Augustana. She's a freshman. She's been there probably 4 weeks. She's homesick. The first wave of real homesickness is setting. She remembers a young brother or sister at home, and I have them write a description of a sunset, and all of a sudden I get this theme, and it says, "Tonight, the sky outside my dorm room looks like a child has colored outside the lines." I'll never forget that line.
Yeah, you've told me
that
before.
That put me in my place, far in the west at day's end, old soul. Oh, geez. Oh. And the word that bothers me most is upon the horizon. Oh, tweet, you know. But to get students to have the nerve to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's to me what good writing is. Conrad told the truth, and Hardy told the truth. They happen to be different truths. Shakespeare somehow has some kind of, his window must be incredibly high up and incredibly clear because, it's unbelievable.
And yet the humanity of the man, I think the most revealing thing, I've dealt with Shakespeare all my life, directing his plays, and I after a while you think you know how he thinks. Although you could never have the breadth of his humanity or his skill in just capturing in a few words the essence of anything. But John Aubrey's, this guy who roamed around England sponging off people, and he kept a diary of conversations he had with people. And he had a conversation with the son of one of the actors who was with Shakespeare. And two things in there that were revelations. That it was said, Johnson said he had little Latin and less Greek, and the young man said, "Oh no, he knew Latin pretty well because he taught in the country when he was a young man." That was new; no one had known that. And then the second thing was when he was invited out for a party, he cried pain. He didn't go out and carouse. I'm sure he was a good fellow, and they talk about he enjoyed, well, everybody drank in those days because you drank the water, it'd kill you. But Ben Jonson and those, whom he championed, by the way, but he kept pretty much to himself. And all of a sudden, with those two lines, I understood the man. I really understood him. He's been criticized because he was more concerned about his family standing back in Stratford than anything right. else. And all of a sudden, I understood this guy. And it was that was one of the most interesting things I ever read. I'm not fascinated by anything else in John Aubrey's diary, but that. But reading.
And writing.
Read and write. Well, writing is hard. Writing is really hard. I try that every week, and it's hard. You want to make it sound as if you're speaking, but dear me, is it hard to do?
Why do you think it's so hard?
Because I'm afraid.
Well, yeah.
I'm afraid. That's exactly. When you write something, there it is. You can go back and see it years later and be proven a fool. But when I say something on the radio, how do you know you heard exactly what I said?
Right.
You know, there's. Things get a little slippery in conversation.
Right, they do.
But writing maketh an exact man.
And I think, to continue James' metaphor, you have a window that no one else can see out of, too. And if you don't give people some hint of what's behind your window, they're going to miss out, too. Maybe not as much as reading Shakespeare, but they're going to miss out something.
But, who is to say what person, I've often thought about that. I write a newspaper column. Why me? It was the whim of the owner of the paper to have me write a column,
right.
which I didn't really want to do. But I thought, why me? There are all kinds of people around here who have interesting lives and interesting ideas.
Well, in fact, I think every one of them. You know, the idea that I'm not a very creative person. To be human, right? I mean, you have to be creative. The child, apparently, at the age of 2 or 3 months, when the parent passes a ball behind the back and pulls it out the other hand, and to the child, that's two different balls. But there must come a day when all of a sudden that child makes a leap of imagination and it knows it's the same ball. Or even, apparently, they say, the ball stationary and the ball moving are two different objects to a young 2-month-old child. But there must come a day, just like the Sherpas in Nepal, who until we began climbing Mount Everest had no idea that one half of the mountain was the same mountain as the other half.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment that what Jacob Bronowski calls a leap of imagination, right? And to be human is to, you know, there are no non-creative human beings. There are no non-writers. There are people who don't write and who are afraid to write and who don't have any interest in writing, but they could write.
Yeah. Well, I took it on because I thought it would be a good discipline. And it took me a while to develop a conscience. Even if I have nothing to say, I'm going to write.
Right.
And that becomes all too obvious sometimes.
Right.
If you can produce your number of words every week, then you're a newspaper columnist. But I don't know that any other standards apply. It's a strange thing. But other writing. Writing fiction? No way. I just can't do that.
Have you tried?
You know, I'm a very lazy guy, Roald. I'll try it, turn it over in my mind. And if it doesn't present itself in a finished state or something approaching that, then I drop it. I almost sat down and wrote a play one time. I suddenly thought, you know, two-character plays are very popular.
Right.
I thought of a two-character play in a situation. I thought, yeah, I could write this. I could build on a conversation I had recently, take it a different way, and this could be interesting. And then I forgot about it.
Well, what do you call what you do for the Greek comedy in the Genesius Guild every summer except write plays?
Hack work. I look at the plot and I...
Loosely. Very loosely.
I take as much of the plot as I can and the characters... And then I try to think of what could be funny. What was a funny situation? And if the plot doesn't yield it, well, what's going on around us that's kind of silly or could be made or is important but could be made fun of? And then I just drop those in. And to me, it's...
Sounds suspiciously like fiction to me, Don.
Well, you have a suspicious mind. That's all, Roald. And of course, you're the great conniver in trying to get people to write. That's your mission in life, apparently.
Yeah, I'll do anything to get and screw up assignments. But I think getting people writing, and I've heard from students too, that did not write until I sort of goaded them into it, or made fun of them, or did something about how glad they were that they did finally write.
Yeah. And this is normally the time we do the book bag, and we have a little time left for that. We have recommendations from readers, and I've been asked, how do they get the information to us?
Well, they've been sticking my mailbox full of books and suggestions. They've stopped me in person. I've talked to a lot of people who work for APRIS. But we perhaps need to make this a little more organized and regular. So if you have a book that you've read, and the people that have suggested books to me have suggested an incredible number of books with not a single repeat so far. So there are a lot of good books out there that probably deserve attention. If you've read a book that you think other people ought to read or might like, particularly the listeners of this program. Could you send the name of the book and your name and about a four-sentence short review to wvik.org? Mm-hmm. And it will get to us, and we will eventually use it on this program and pass your suggestions on to our other listeners.
Someone gave me a book to look at, and it is weird. It's called What If? Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. It's by Randall Monroe. And to give you an idea, here are some of the questions people have asked. From what height would you need to drop a steak for it to be cooked when it hit the ground? Stupid question, but he gives a serious scientific answer to it. Another, if everyone on the planet stayed away from each other for a couple of weeks, wouldn't the common cold be wiped out? Or, if a glass of water was all of a sudden, what if a glass of water was all of a sudden literally half empty? And he explores that. Do you mean a vacuum? If the top half was a vacuum, what would occur? If the bottom half were a vacuum, what would happen? And this may be a bit gruesome, but if someone's DNA suddenly vanished, how long would that person last? I tell you, it's given humanity's current knowledge and capabilities, is it possible to build a new star? If people had wheels and could fly, how would we differentiate them from airplanes? Some of these he examines at great length. What would happen if a hairdryer with continuous power were turned on and put in an airtight 1 by 1 by 1 meter box? Or, how many, suppose you had a bunch of machine guns and fired them at the ground, would that enable you to rise up from the earth? And if so, how far, and so on? And he goes into great detail with every one of these.
Should be possible.
Well, it, you know, you look at it, and then at the end of some of it, he just says something to the point that, well, of course, this is totally absurd. But it's called What If? By Randall Monroe. I thought it was one of those silly sort of books, you know, that pop up around Christmas time. But it's interesting, the heavy science he brings to this. And just goes to show you, you know, you can make a book out of almost anything. And he certainly did this. What If? By Randall Monroe, Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. And I suppose on that point of absurdity, we probably ought to think about winding up for today. We want to thank you for tuning in. I'm Don Wooten here with Roll Tweet. We'll be back next week as we are every Saturday at noon, and we hope you'll join us for the next session of Scribble. And remember, you can send in your reviews to wvik.org. See you next week.